Marty Moscoen, welcome to Radio Times. The Trump presidential campaign is running out of legal options in its efforts to overturn the 2020 election, which has already been called for Joe Biden. The campaign filed multiple court challenges in Pennsylvania and lost two in the last few days. On Friday night, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit ruled against the campaign that had appealed a previous ruling to block the certification of the election results. The judge writing for the court said, quote, calling an election unfair does not make it so. Charges require specific allegations and then proof. We have neither here. Then on Saturday night, Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled unanimously against Republican Congressman Mike Kelly's lawsuit to toss all of Pennsylvania's mail-in ballots, all 2.6 million of them. They said he waited too long to challenge the 2019 law that allowed no-excuse mail-in voting that was passed overwhelmingly by the Republican-controlled legislature. We asked Kermit Roosevelt to walk us through these legal decisions, what options remain for the Trump campaign, whether President Trump can pardon himself, and whether the Biden administration could or should investigate the Trump administration. Kermit Roosevelt is a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School. Kermit, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And to our listeners, you can join us as well. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We are almost a month out from Election Day. How unprecedented, Kermit, is it to challenge the results of an election and offer little to no evidence of fraud in a court of law?
Well, it's unprecedented. You know, we always hope that the elections will be settled by the voters and not the courts, and usually that happens. Sometimes there is an election that's so close and there is a legal issue that's fairly debatable, and as in Bush v. Gore, it ends up in the courts. But what's unusual about this election is it wasn't nearly as close, and you've got a lot of lawsuits not focused on one specific narrow issue, but making these very broad and really entirely unsubstantiated claims of massive systemic fraud.
Is it kind of like throwing spaghetti at the courtroom wall?
Well, that's certainly the impression you get reading the court filings. There's a bunch of different theories that they were putting forward. There are a lot of different suits. So they did seem to be doing this throw it all at the wall, see if it sticks strategy. It was relatively foreseeable, I think, that none of it was going to stick, though.
Are there reasons, though? I mean, you mentioned Bush v. Gore, and that, of course, happened in 20 years ago. But are there specific reasons, even in the Constitution, that an election can be overturned? Is it about fraud, about something that was fraudulent that happened either during the election or as the votes were being counted?
To overturn an election, you really would need pretty dramatic evidence and pretty dramatic wrongdoing. So courts have demanding standards for proof of fraud. And in an election, because we're so committed to the idea that it's the voters who should decide, it takes something extraordinary for a court to come in and invalidate an election.
So you need proof. I mean, you need to be – what you can say on Twitter or at a press a news conference is different from what you can say in a court of law.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, one of the amazing things about this litigation has been that, you know, on the one hand, when the lawyers are actually in court and subject to sanctions for misrepresentation or for saying things without a proper foundation, they tend to back down a lot on the claims. When the judge actually asks them, are you alleging fraud? Some of the lawyers have said, no, we're not.
I want to quote from, and this is from the judge who wrote the opinion for the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. I'm going to probably mispronounce his last name, Stefanos Bibas. But he is a Trump appointee, and the other two members of this court are two George W. Bush appointees. Not only did Bibas talk about the evidence being led on facts, but then he said, and it's something I think we should talk about, voters, not lawyers, choose the president. President, ballots, not briefs, decide elections. Alchemy cannot transmute lead into gold. And some of these rulings from these judges have been not just critical, but really scathing and pointed.
Well, they have been. And I think that's understandable. One of the things about Donald Trump and his relationship to judges is that he seems to feel that the judges he appoints should be loyal to him personally and should rule in his favor because he appointed them. And I think any judge would be offended by that suggestion. Stefanos Bibas was a colleague of mine at the University of Pennsylvania Law School.
Oh, wow.
Certainly, that's not his idea of how judges behave. You know, you can see in that opinion very clearly he understands how democracy works. He understands that an independent federal judiciary is not there to do the bidding of the president that appointed them. And I think that courts are understandably offended at being enlisted in this effort to subvert the will of the people.
Do you think that the president is hurting our democracy by these various lawsuits?
Oh, absolutely. You know, on the one hand, it sets this terrible precedent of how to react when an election goes against you. And on the other hand, more concretely, it inspires distrust in the millions of people out there who fervently believe everything that Donald Trump says. It's going to be much harder for Biden to govern, as he said he wants to, as the president of everyone, not just the people who voted for him, because the people who voted against him are being told he's not really their president.
You mentioned the fact that you think a lot of the judges and a lot of the responses to these allegations were offended by what the Trump campaign brought to the courts. Is it legal to bring, you know, I use the word frivolous. I don't know if there's a legal definition of it, but the idea of bringing frivolous lawsuit one after another to a court, is there something illegal about that?
Well, lawyers can be sanctioned for that. Parties can be sanctioned for that. There are provisions about frivolous litigation. It's a very high bar, and it doesn't get invoked that often. I think it's probably unlikely that anything would happen in this case. And usually the problem with frivolous litigation is that it wastes everyone's time and it costs money to the person who's being sued. They have to defend themselves when they shouldn't even be in court. Here, really, I think the concern is more the damage that this is doing to our democratic system. And that, unfortunately, that's something that sanctions for frivolous litigation can't address.
The campaign, or what's left of it, has tweeted that they want to take, this was after one of the rulings in Pennsylvania, they wanted to take their case to the U.S. Supreme Court. Based on what we know about this newly reconfigured court with its latest, the newest justice, Kermit, is there any way to know whether they would take a case like this, whatever, you know, this is?
Well, I think the chances that they would take it are vanishingly small. There doesn't really seem to be an issue of federal law present in the state court suit. In the Third Circuit decision, what was being decided there was actually whether the Trump campaign would be allowed to amend their complaint to bring back in some claims that they said they had accidentally deleted. Given the narrowness of the issue there and given the fact that even changing the outcome in Pennsylvania wouldn't alter the outcome in the overall election, it doesn't really seem like there's any reason for the Supreme Court to take the case.
And, I mean, tweeting it is one thing. What does it take to actually bring a case to the U.S. Supreme Court? What do you have to do?
Well, you have to file a petition for certiorari, and then the Supreme Court will decide whether or not they want to hear it. And they'll hear a case if it's of exceptional national importance. They'll hear a case if different federal courts of appeals disagree about a constitutional question or about the meaning of federal law. But they don't have to hear many cases. There are a very small number of cases where their review is non-discretionary. But in this case, they wouldn't have to. Usually, they don't like getting involved in highly charged political issues. And given that this lawsuit doesn't actually hold any possibility of changing the outcome of the national election, it seems extremely unlikely that they would be interested.
I mentioned this before, and we actually have a comment from Larry saying that Trump has raised $170 million since the election and continues to blitz with fundraising emails. I get a half a dozen or more every day. Trump knows he's lost. It's just a craven attempt to make money while subverting public trust in elections. He will do this when he's out of office, too. And a number of news organizations have looked at these fundraising emails talking about money coming in to fight the election. But when you dig deep, you you find out that most of the money is going to go to a new political action committee. Some of the money is going to go to the Republican Party. And it seems like some loose change might go to fighting these election results. Is there anything we should take away from this, and maybe even legally or even constitutionally?
Well, again, you know, I think it's just a breathtaking display of cynicism in a number of ways. One is that the whole premise of the lawsuits really was, we don't need evidence, we're just going to say this was unfair and hope that judges we've appointed will rule in our favor, which is just not the way the legal system works, as Judge Bevis said.
Right.
But the other thing is that, yes, you know, given that they don't have a massive legal operation going on, given that they don't have a lot of meaningful claims to put forward, what are they going to do with this money? They'll do something else. You know, they'll support the Republican Party. They'll support Donald Trump. And that also is really, I think, a terrible betrayal of their supporters who believe that some terrible wrong has been done, and they believe that they're out there fighting for the will of the people when, in fact, they're just being fleeced.
The courts have spoken. It's not unanimous, but, you know, a lot of the court rulings have been against the Trump campaign. Is there something that courts can do beyond that to try to mend whatever damage has been done to our democracy because of this?
I'm afraid that that's not really something that the courts can do. Now, I mean, you've seen them issuing these strongly worded opinions.
Right.
Which I think is about as much as courts can do, you know, to say this is not the way elections are decided in America. But unfortunately, what we really need is political leaders to be communicating in a non-divisive way. And Donald Trump has been extraordinarily divisive and continues to be. And that's the real problem, I think.
Meaning, I mean, we certainly hear from the Democrats. You're talking about political leaders from the Republican Party?
Yes. So the idea that the other side of the aisle politically, that they're not just political opponents, but they're enemies, and that it's fundamentally illegitimate for them to hold power, and therefore that any way of keeping them out of power and beating them is justified, that's an idea that I think, you know, far more on the right than on the left, but that's an idea that is gaining currency on both sides of the political spectrum. And that's what makes it impossible to have a well-functioning democracy.
And that is Kermit Roosevelt, our guest in this first half of Radio Times. He's a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School. We've been talking about a number of the legal challenges in the state of Pennsylvania coming from the Trump administration, challenging the results of the election of almost a month ago. We'll be talking about whether the president can pardon himself, and also whether the Biden administration could or should investigate the Trump administration. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Kermit Roosevelt. He's a constitutional law professor at Penn. We've been talking about the Trump campaign running out of legal options in Pennsylvania, losing two important cases in recent days, one in federal court and one before the state Supreme Court, wanting to overturn the results of the election here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And I do want to talk about some of the other constitutional issues being raised by this election and the results of this election as well. Let me ask you, Kermit, I know there are probably, depending on how many lawyers you talk to, you might get multiple responses to this question. Can the president pardon himself? And he has said in interviews that he believes he can.
Well, it's a difficult question. And as you said, different lawyers and different scholars have different views on it. My guess is that the best reading of the Constitution is the president cannot pardon himself. Not because of anything in the words themselves. The Constitution says the president can grant pardons, doesn't say who he can or can't grant them to. but because it would effectively put the president above the law and make him a judge in his own case. And those are two pretty fundamental principles of our constitutional system that suggest the president shouldn't be allowed to pardon himself.
Does the Constitution say those words in any overt or direct way?
No, it doesn't.
There is, maybe you're referring to this 1974 Justice Department Office of Legal Counsel memo that says, quote, under the fundamental rule that no one may be a judge of his own case, the president cannot pardon himself. Is that the law that sort of defines what might happen next?
Well, that's
one opinion.
Or memo,
I guess. It's not really a law, right?
Yeah, the memo doesn't bind the president. He could certainly try this. The problem is that there are some things that people can do for themselves. So, you know, a doctor could treat herself. A lawyer can represent himself. But there are some sorts of things where that doesn't really make sense. So a prosecutor couldn't prosecute himself. And because when the president issues a pardon, the president is acting like a judge and saying this person deserves to have this offense forgiven, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to say the president can make that determination about himself.
Like other presidents, President Trump has pardoned people, Michael Flynn being the most recent ones. If you are pardoned by a president, are there protections that you lose in court? I read somewhere that you actually lose the right to the Fifth Amendment protection of self-incrimination. Is that true?
Yes, it is. So one of the ways in which the Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination can be overcome in the ordinary context is if the prosecutor gives you immunity, because you can't be compelled to say anything that might incriminate you. But if you've been promised immunity, if you've been granted immunity, then there's no fear. There's no danger of you being prosecuted in the future. And in just the same way, if you've been pardoned for something, you can't assert a Fifth Amendment right to refuse to talk about it.
There's another question, I think, hanging over what happens next. There's the possibility, although it seems like the Biden elect team is not interested in any kind of investigation or even legal pursuit of President Trump when he leaves office and members of his administration. Where do you stand on that idea that a incoming administration would then investigate an outgoing administration?
Well, no one likes the idea, I think, of an incoming administration investigating the outgoing administration. That's the sort of thing that looks like using the political and judicial system to pursue a political vendetta. And, you know, we often say that's not how our system works. However, as I said before, we also have this principle that no one is above the law. And the idea that you can't investigate and you can't prosecute someone just because they're politically powerful people, well, that politicizes the law enforcement function just as much. And it effectively shields powerful people from legal liability, which is also a bad thing. So I think investigation is probably warranted. It's worth trying to figure out some of the things that the Mueller report left open, for instance, and whether there was criminal behavior that can be established.
Specifically, what are you referring to in the Mueller report?
Well, the Mueller report said certain things about obstruction of justice. They said if we could have established that the president did not commit a crime, we would have said that. And we are not saying that. Now, the Mueller report ended up being spun by the attorney general to make it look as though it had found conclusively that the president was innocent of various things. But it didn't actually say that. It said in some cases things couldn't be established. And it was influenced by the fact that Mueller believed he lacked the power to indict a sitting president. A sitting president couldn't be indicted. So I think it's certainly fair to say there are some things there that should be revisited.
Would that be a special we're looking deep into our crystal ball here. Would that be a special prosecutor? If that is worth investigating, how would you suggest we go about it?
I'm not sure. You could have a special prosecutor. You could have congressional investigations and hearings. It could be done in a number of different ways.
But would that be unprecedented? Have we done that before? Have we had an incoming administration investigate an outgoing administration?
Well, we've had investigations into particular policies or programs. You know, when things go wrong in the United States, we generally have a commission. And the commission looks into what happened and tries to figure out why and tries to figure out how to prevent that in the future. You know, we did that with the 9/11 attacks. We did that with the torture program. We did that with the wartime detention of Japanese Americans. And I feel like there were things that went wrong during the Trump administration that are worth looking into. So we could at the least have that kind of investigation and commission report.
Here's a comment from Dave.
Then the question is whether anyone accountable. Yeah, sorry. Then the question is whether you try to hold anyone accountable for wrongdoing that is uncovered. And I think, honestly, a big mistake that Obama made was in deciding that we would look forward, not back, with respect to torture, and not actually have anyone suffer any consequences for their violations of the Constitution and the laws of this nation.
Let me read a couple of comments. We've got one from Dave. He says, the left disputed the 2016 election, Russian interference, etc., and never accepted President Trump as legitimate. How is the right's position in 2020 any different? Kermit?
Well, I'm not sure that people didn't accept Trump as legitimate. I mean, there certainly was concern about the impact that the Russians had had on the election. I don't think that you saw the same sort of attempts, one, to overturn the election in court, and two, to get state legislatures to change their mind. There was actually a movement for electors to suggest that electors in the Electoral College could cast their vote for someone else. But the other distinction is I think there was just much, much more evidence that something bad actually did happen in the 2016 election.
It's interesting. I mean, you mentioned electors, and we have a complicated way that we elect our presidents, but this is the system that we have. The Electoral College and the electors are going to be voting relatively soon. Do they, by law, have to represent the will of the people in their respective states?
In some states, they do. So some states have laws that bind the electors to follow their pledge. So they have to vote for the candidate that they're pledged to. Most states do not. And even the states that do have such laws, generally the enforcement mechanism is just a small fine. So the elector can actually vote for someone else if they want. And maybe they have to pay $1,000. But in those states, apparently the elector's vote is effective no matter who it's cast for.
Here's a comment from Gregory. At some level, I think Trump has been operating under the assumption that once he was able to appoint 3 Supreme Court justices, his thinking that they will side with any suit that he could get heard by that court. Trump administration was able to put many judges on the bench, some the U.S. Supreme Court, some of the lower courts. How much do you think that administration has changed the judiciary?
Well, I think it's changed the judiciary quite significantly, and most notably on the Supreme Court, but also the lower federal courts. But I never thought, and I still don't think, that Trump was able to create a pro-Trump judiciary. So most of his judicial appointments have been highly credentialed conservatives, people that the Federalist Society likes, and all of his Supreme Court appointments fit that mold. So he's definitely moved the courts to the right. But there's nothing about a conservative judicial philosophy that would actually make you like Trump as a person. There's nothing about a conservative judicial philosophy that would make you sympathetic to baseless claims of election fraud. So to the extent that what has happened to the federal courts is they've shifted right, it's not necessarily going to make them more pro-Trump.
Well, Kermit Roosevelt, we have to leave it there. And my thanks to you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks,
Kermit.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And he's a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School. Mossef Fakhrizadeh The top Iranian nuclear scientist was buried yesterday after being killed in a targeted attack on Friday. Iran's leadership has blamed Israel for the assassination, promising to seek revenge, while Israel has been mum about the incident. While President Trump withdrew the U.S. from the nuclear agreement with Iran that had been negotiated by the Obama administration, President-elect Biden has promised to return to the bargaining table. Today, why was Fakhrizadeh killed? How does it complicate policy for the incoming Biden administration? How different is today's Middle East from the region when Biden was vice president? And joining us is Barbara Slavin. She's director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. Barbara Slavin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for asking me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times and to join our conversation. You and others have described this top nuclear scientist as the mastermind of a past weapons program. Who is Mohsen Fakhrizadeh?
Well, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was very involved in an effort that took place in Iran about 20 years ago to develop a small warhead that could fit on a missile. This was a program that our CIA found out about, the Israeli Mossad found out about, and the program was basically suspended in 2003 after it was revealed that Iran also had facilities for enriching uranium, for making centrifuges. The program was basically, I wouldn't say it was shut down. I mean, there are different interpretations about exactly what Fakhrizadeh has been up to in the last 20 years.
Interesting.
But clearly a dedicated weapons program was stopped. And the work that Iran actually has been doing more recently does not have much to do with Fakhrizadeh's expertise. This is mostly on enriching uranium. I think what people miss in this whole debate is that the question of whether Iran does or doesn't have a nuclear weapon comes down largely to political will. Iran's nuclear program is more than 60 years old. The United States gave Iran its first reactor in the 1960s. And Iran has produced, nuclear physicists and engineers for many decades. So Iran knows how to make a bomb if it wants to. So the question is how to make it in Iran's interest not to build a bomb. And that's where the Iran nuclear deal of 2015 came in. You know, there was a trade. Iran got relief of certain sanctions that had been put on by the United States and the United Nations, other countries. In return, it promised to accept stringent inspection and limitations on the amount of enriched uranium it could have until the year 2031.
Right. And I do want to pick up on that. I still have questions, though, about what happened on Friday. And as you said that he, and I do hope I'm pronouncing his last name correctly,
Fakhrizadeh,
that he, you know, was not a current leading member of the nuclear scientist team. So why do you think he was targeted, and was he targeted by Israel?
Yes, I believe he was targeted by Israel, and I think it was because they saw an opportunity. They saw him perhaps as a potential threat again in the future. We have to acknowledge that Iran has been moving outside the limits of this nuclear agreement for the past year or so as a result of the United States quitting the deal when Iran was still in full compliance with it. And also, I think there are other motivations, namely that the Israelis are very good at these kinds of assassinations. They killed a half dozen Iranian scientists previously, and they've killed other people. And also, I think Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, feels that he has a blank check from Donald Trump, as long as Trump is president, to do whatever he wants, frankly. In the region, particularly against Iran. And then the final element is that I'm sure the Israelis saw this as a way of complicating Biden's diplomacy with Iran. If Iran were to retaliate, if this were to deteriorate further, that would make it very difficult for Biden to return to the Iran nuclear deal and to diplomacy.
I mean, it does seem the timing is very significant. But do you think, I mean, we don't know what Iran is going to do, but do you think Israel wants, does it want to go to war with Iran? Is it already at some kind of low-grade war if it is doing these targeted assassinations within the country, which is interesting?
Yeah. Israel doesn't want a full-scale war with Iran because that would unleash groups like Hezbollah in Lebanon, which have thousands, tens of thousands of rockets and other artillery that it could unleash on Israeli civilians. Israel thinks it can get away with these kinds of attacks because Iran doesn't want a full-scale war and because Iran wants a return to the Iran nuclear deal and relief of sanctions. The sanctions have pummeled the Iranian economy. And of course, Iran is also suffering from COVID, really terrible. Numbers of people, 50,000 dead officially, and probably many, many more. So the Israelis think they can get away with it. That's why they did it.
We're almost having a break here, but how much do you think this was an inside job and maybe even collaborators or spies working within Iran to attack this top nuclear scientist?
Well, that's a very worrisome question for the Iranian intelligence establishment. I mean, this is a massive failure for them. And they have suffered other failures. Qasem Soleimani, the head of an elite force of the Iranian, of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, was killed in a drone strike in Iraq by the United States in January of this year. And that shows there was perhaps some lack of appreciation of the danger that Soleimani was in. After he was killed, the same organization shot down a Ukrainian civilian airliner accidentally, thinking it was a hostile plane.
Well, let's take a very short break, talking with Barbara Slavin, director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council, talking about the targeted assassination of a nuclear scientist on Friday and where that leaves the region, where it leaves the U.S. and the incoming Biden administration. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Barbara Slavin, director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council, talking about the assassination of a leading nuclear scientist in Iran on Friday, how that could upend President-elect Joe Biden's plans to return to negotiations with Iran over its nuclear program. The killing also has domestic implications for Iran and is raising the stakes of retaliation against Israel, the presumed mastermind of the attack. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Barbara Slavin, where does this lead the incoming Biden administration? Joe Biden has said, President-elect Joe Biden has said he wants to get back to the table and get back to this nuclear deal that was negotiated under President Obama.
Well, look, assuming that the region does not deteriorate into full-scale war, and the Iranians continue to show restraint despite not just these attacks, but there have been cyber attacks on their main centrifuge facility, a lot of mysterious explosions in recent months in Iran that may also be attributed to the Israelis. Assuming that it doesn't deteriorate further, I think the Biden administration can still come back into the Iran nuclear deal. They can do this through a series of executive orders, really the same way that Donald Trump quit the deal. And we've written a paper at the Atlantic Council called Renewing Transatlantic Strategy on Iran, on how the Europeans can facilitate this by basically meeting with the Iranians and setting up a roadmap for a return to mutual compliance with the agreement.
Well, and we forget sometimes that we weren't the sole party to this agreement. There were others there as well from Europe. But you did mention the fact that Iran has been developing since the Trump administration pulled us out of the agreement, has basically been violating the tenets of the agreement about enrichment of uranium. Does that mean our partners were not doing their job?
No, look, the Iranians have made it very clear that the steps they've taken can be reversed. What they have done is they've produced more enriched uranium than they are supposed to under the agreement. Mm-hmm. However, they've not enriched it to dangerously high levels. To make a bomb, you need uranium that's enriched to about 80% of the isotope U-235. And Iran has been keeping the enrichment levels at 5% or below. I'm sorry, somebody
That's
is
okay.
calling me.
And I you're very popular, Barbara Slavin.
Yes.
This is what happens.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, it's been busy. Anyway, Iran has been keeping the enrichment level to 5% or below. So it's nowhere near having the ability to sort of dash for a bomb. And the Iranians made it very clear when they took these steps that they could reverse them and would reverse them if the United States would return to compliance.
So are they using it for nuclear energy? What are they developing this uranium for?
They're doing it now as a bargaining chip to get the United okay. States back in, clearly.
Are there inspectors in Iran, or were they pulled as well?
Oh, yes. That's one of the most important things, frankly, is that they've not stopped the inspections. They've continued to allow the inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna to inspect all their declared facilities, and there are also electronic monitors, cameras and whatnot. So their program is inspected 24/7, and this is something, frankly, I worry that is at risk. You know, if the Israelis keep knocking off Iranian scientists, that contributes to arguments within Iran that the country should scrap what remains of their compliance with this agreement, that they should quit the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which Iran has been a member of since its inception, and that Iran should basically do a North Korea and dash for a weapon, and maybe then they would get some respect from the international community, and the United States would not be assassinating senior generals, and the Israelis would not be acting with impunity within the country. So we have to remember, Iran has politics too.
Well, and it sounds like what you're saying is, and these are very tenuous times, that the hardliners, I guess, could feel emboldened or empowered. And there is an election, correct, coming up in June 2021?
That's right. They're going to have presidential elections. Now, under Iran's system, a cleric, the supreme leader, aptly named, has the last word on all policies. So the president has some influence, however. And what's really important is the team the president brings in. So currently we have a man named Hassan Rouhani, who has a PhD from a university in Scotland. His foreign minister is a man named Javad Zarif, who not only studied in the United States and of course speaks fluent English, but was Iran's UN ambassador in the early and mid 2000s. He knows Joe Biden. Joe Biden used to meet with him when Biden was in the Senate. Zarif negotiated the nuclear agreement. His team is still in place. So obviously it'd be much easier to return to the deal and to talk about other things with this team than with the team that might come in after Iranian elections in June. So that's another argument for a rapid return on all sides to compliance.
Let me read a couple of comments. One from Ken: why would we ever expect Iran to cooperate with the U.S. when we are this aggressive to them after breaching our own deal? What possible rationale would they have not to build a nuclear weapon? Nukes seem to be the only deterrent to regime change, not to mention Israel has a nuclear arsenal. And, I mean, this is the complications of the Middle East and also of the threat of nuclear weapons.
Yeah, look, this is a very reasonable argument. And there are a lot of people in Iran who've never trusted the United States. And actions like this assassination with the obvious approval of the Trump administration certainly don't help the case of those who say that Iran needs good relations with the West. So, you know, it's very damaging on all levels. I mean, you know, is this really how the United States wants to be known as a country that, you know, turns a blind eye to assassinations? I think it's an unfortunate legacy, frankly, of 9/11 in many ways. You know, we got used to the fact that we could just go around the world and kill people because we thought they were a threat to the United States.
Can we trust Iran, or perhaps I'll put it another way? I mean, does Iran want to return to the table, talk with the U.S., if renegotiate or update or get the deal up and running again, and have the sanctions lifted? Is that their goal?
Well, you can't just talk about Iran. It's, you know, it's not a monolith. As I mentioned, there are some people who don't want Iran to go back into compliance. They would like Iran to kick out the inspectors and really build up a nuclear deterrent against Israel and the United States and other countries. But the current administration in Iran has said they want to go back in, and clearly most Iranians, I think, would appreciate sanctions relief. So that's why I think we have a limited amount of time to work on this. Can I just say, by the way, I mean, I was listening to your previous guest.
Sure,
and do
Kermit.
Do people know who Kermit Roosevelt's father, grandfather was?
Well, it's interesting that you say that, Barbara. I know we didn't actually do this on purpose, but there is a connection there, man. Go ahead.
I mean, his grandfather engineered a coup, which got rid of a very popular Iranian prime minister in 1953, a man named Mohammad Mossadegh, whose government nationalized Iranian oil, which had been controlled by the British, and basically cut short Iran's hope for a more democratic system of government in 1953. You know, and here we are, and in a way paved the way for not only the return of their king, the Shah, but paved the way for the Islamic Revolution of 1979. So I was enjoying. I mean, here he is talking about defending American democracy when his grandfather helped kill Iran's chance at democracy in 1953. It was just, you know, the historical echoes are really marvelous.
Well, I'm glad you raised that. I was looking for the point about how to bring that in, but you did that just at the right time, Barbara Slavin. But I also think it's important for, because I bet most Americans do not know that, but I'm assuming people in Iran, I mean, you know, they may not have been alive in the 1950s, but they know this history that we do not know about the U.S. involvement in that country.
Of course they do. You know, I mean, we think of the hostage crisis, many of us, how Iranian students took American diplomats hostage, you know, right after the revolution and held them for 444 days with the blessing of the then supreme leader, Ayatollah Khomeini. You know, Americans may remember that. They may look to the fact that Iran is still holding Americans for no good reason. But Iranians think of Mossadegh being overthrown. They also recall that the United States supported Iraq during a terrible war in the 1980s that killed a quarter of a million Iranians. And the U.S. actually shot down an Iranian civilian airliner toward the end of that war, killing, I think, all 290 people on board. It was a mistake, but it's something that Iranians think was deliberate, many of them. So, you know, this relationship has been very fraught for a long time, and we have committed a lot of, how shall I put it? We've committed terrible acts toward each other. There is no doubt, and it's in that context that maybe Americans will see Israel killing an Iranian nuclear scientist and think, why not?
Let me read a couple of comments related to Israel. One from Stuart, he says, your program leaves out what options does Israel have? They're being surrounded by missiles owned by a country openly determined to destroy Israel and Jews. And your guest takes exception to killing the executioner. A comment from Bruce, although this assassination was of questionable judgment, how can you entirely blame Israel of their possible action? Basically underscoring what Stuart said. What do you say in response to that?
Yeah, well, again, you know, if there's a more dysfunctional relationship than the one between Iran and the United States, it's the one between Iran and Israel. Mm-hmm. And once again, these countries were close under the Shah and after the revolution, which had a very Islamic character to it, the Islamic Revolution, the government changed its view, although, mind you, it took weapons from the Israelis during the 1980s. The relationship got really hostile after the defeat of Saddam Hussein in the 1991 Gulf War. Then the Israelis began to see Iran as a threat. Previously, they had seen Iraq as a bigger threat. And the Iranians started to support groups like Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which carried out terrorist acts in Israel, suicide bombings. So really, since the early 1990s, Iran and Israel have been on the outs. You know, it takes two. You can ask who started this. Certainly, the Israelis have been demonizing Iran for a long time, but Iran has also used harsh rhetoric. Sure. And, you know, its supreme leader has talked about wiping Israel from the pages of history. So this is a relationship that also needs a great deal of work. But you can ask yourself, does killing this man, Fakhrizadeh, does that help? Is that going to resolve the differences? Is that going to make Iran more interested in detente with Israel? I don't think so.
Here's a comment from Paul. He says, Pompeo and Netanyahu met with bin Salman, of course, of Saudi Arabia, a week or two before the hit on the Iranian nuclear chief. Any connection, Paul asks?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if the United States had advance warning or the Saudis had advance warning of this. You know, clearly Donald Trump has told the Israelis, do what you want while I'm still in power. I'm not going to stop you. You know, I don't think Trump wants the United States to be involved in a massive war with Iran. And there was a story in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago that Trump had asked for options to attack Iran's main nuclear facility. And that actually Pompeo and Mark Esper, the then defense secretary, told him this would not be a good idea. Because, of course, the U.S. still has troops in the region, maybe fewer of them, but still a number, and they would be vulnerable to retaliation. But I think that it's entirely possible that the United States knew this hit was coming.
Hmm. Final question. How different is the Middle East today than it was when Biden was vice president? We have this peace agreement between Israel and the UAE and Bahrain, Israel's warmer relationships with Saudi Arabia. How do you see even this nuclear deal, if assuming it gets restarted, how do you see this all fitting together in 1 minute or less? Sorry about that.
Oh, boy.
Well,
obviously, you know, situations change. The Palestinian issue isn't what it used to be. Even the Iranians have to recognize that. But Iran is still a very important power in the region. And I think that the Biden administration understands that perhaps better than Trump has.
Are you optimistic that there can be some kind of resolution to some of these conflicts?
Yes, I am. Primarily because of the personnel that are coming in with Joe Biden, people like Tony Blinken and Jake Sullivan, who have prior experience negotiating with the Iranians. So, yes, I am hopeful.
Well, that's so nice to end a show on a hopeful note. It's been a long time, it seems like. Barbara Slavin, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
You're welcome. Thanks for asking.
You're welcome. And she's director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council, the second of two guests in this hour of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. And you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us. Yes.